Hello and welcome to episode 43 of the podcast we call Two Chairs Talking. My name is David Grigg and I'm joined as always by my co-host, Perry Middlemiss. How are you, Perry? How was your New Year?
Good, thank you, David. Didn't do a lot. I drove to Adelaide on New Year's Day, so that was something to do in the New Year, and then back again earlier after about 3 or 4 days. But didn't do anything on New Year's Eve. Just thought it probably best to not go out and gallivant around the countryside with certain plague diseases floating around. I'm still there. I mean, we're being ultra careful now, but you know, we did so much work through the early or the middle part of 2020. You don't want to throw away all that good work now, do you?
No, nothing. We certainly don't. It was a hard yakka, and we managed to get on top of it, so we want to stay on top of it.
And how was the rest of your break? Was the
We managed to get together with because a lot of the restrictions have been lifted. We were able to get together with my family for Christmas, and my mother was able to come from her aged care centre. But
that's good.
Unfortunately, that hasn't lasted long because of the new resurgence of the virus. They're back in lockdown there, but at least she was able to be there for Christmas. So that was lovely.
Oh, that's good. Well, the one thing we can say about this current slight, and it really is only a slight little uptick in the numbers, is that we don't think it's going to be around for terribly much longer in terms of the restrictions. Mm. And I think we're just going to cop these a little bit on and off all year until the vaccinations all come through.
Yep.
And enough of us are vaccinated that we'll be able to get coverage. So how long that's going to be, I reckon probably mid-year before we can really start thinking that we're moving ahead on it. There's just too much to do in too little time. Anyway.
Indeed.
There we are. But it's good to be back podcasting again, David, after about a month's break. It seems like a heck of a long time since we've spoken.
It certainly does. Seems like a very long time. Okay, so let's talk about what we've been reading. 2020 was a memorable year for all sorts of reasons, but I read a lot of good books, and I'm sure you did too. So I thought I would start off with just a bit of a general description of the kind of things I've been reading, the amount I've been reading. So I actually managed to get through 91 books last year, which is, for me, it's a pretty much of a record. Certainly in recent years, it's a record. But I think a lot of that has been driven by this podcast, of course, because we've sort of took on the idea that we would, when we did the Hugo Time Machine segments, we would actually start reading, or reading for the first time in some cases, all of the nominees and winners for those segments for the Hugos in those particular years. And so that's actually added quite a lot of reading to our list of things we had to read. And that's actually, for me, that's actually thrown the balance out all sorts of ways. I certainly have read a lot more science fiction and fantasy than I would normally have been reading, I think. So I actually thought I'd actually count that up and sort of try to discount it in some sort of way. So I reckon I read, out of my 91 books read, I read about some 25 books out of my list of 91 books were really read for the purposes of the podcast. And so that, I'm just going to try and discount that a couple of times in some sort of way. So if I take into account everything I've read, I reckon I read about 45% of my reading this last year was what you might call speculative fiction, science fiction, fantasy, alternative history. 22% was crime and thriller, 17% was what you might call literary, and then the rest was 16% was everything else. But if I set aside those books, those 25 books that I read for the podcast, then that would have been very different. I would have read 30% crime and thriller, only 24% SF fantasy and so on, and about 23% literary or non-genre, and 23% of other stuff. The other thing I like to have a look at each year when I look at the books I've been reading is to ensure that I've been reading a balance of male and female authors. But again, the podcast, and particularly the Hugo Time Machine, has kind of skewed that very badly this year, because a lot of those old nominees for the Hugo were mostly written by men. And so, of course, that throws things out. But if I look at the raw figures, I only get 34% female authors and 66% male authors. But if I exclude the books read purely for the podcast, I get a much better ratio, which is actually 53% female authors to 47% male authors. Without the podcast stuff, the only genres in which I read more male authors than female were SF and the non-fiction genres. Everything else, every other category, I'd read more female authors than male. One last thing before I throw back to Perry is that I've also like to believe I've been reading some translated works in translation. And I only read 6 books like that during 2020, which was only 7% of what I read. I'd like to do better in that area. So there's a number of authors I'd like to follow up more. I'd like to read more books by the Japanese author Haruki Murakami, more by the Strugatsky brothers. And I've just discovered an Icelandic crime writer, which you may know of, Perry, Ragnar Jónasson, who's written a lot of books in the crime genre.
My wife's a big fan.
Is she? All right, okay.
This is the Dark Iceland
series. That's right. I've only read one so far, but the rest of them look pretty good.
Yeah, my wife really likes them.
Yeah, so I'm going to throw it back to Perry. I've done a pretty sloppy job of explaining what I've been reading during the year. He'll probably do a better job than me.
Well, thanks, David. Well, now, see, I like this because this basically goes to show that you're setting yourself targets.
Yeah.
Well, you will be next year, more next year than this, more in 21 than in 20, right? So what you've done is that you've kept really good data and you've looked at it and then you said, I need to improve here because I'm not looking at this. So you think, well, if I'm going to read, say, 10 books in translation, that sounds like a good number to me. And then if you put it as a target, you can keep track of it as you're going. And this is a perfect explanation of the way that I go about doing things because it's the only way I can keep on track. Now, I keep on telling people that I set all these different targets through the year, all these high-level targets and all these sub-targets, but I know full well I'm not going to hit half of them. But it gives me a bit of a prod. It's just sort of saying, no, come back on track, come back on track. No, you've gone too far down this way. Come over this way a little bit. Make sure that in the next month you read this book or that book. And so it keeps me there and keeps me online about where I'm going. So I set myself an overall target beginning of the year. This year it was 102. Well, I got to 119, so it
did pretty good.
Well, in the end, I'm hoping to basically get to the stage where I can hit 10 books a month. So that's 120 in a year. So pretty much got that. It's not quite as many as my maximum. I think I got to 128. A couple of years back, and that was pretty good. But then I was spending a lot of time on trains going to and from work, and I don't have that anymore because I'm no longer in the workforce.
No.
So now I'm basically sitting at home reading it. And when you're at home, there's all these other distractions, which can be a little bit of a problem. But anyway, to give a bit of an overview about where I went to, of the men and women, I reckon I was reasonably close to you in terms of the gender balance overall. Of the 119 books I read during the year, 75 were by men and 44 by women. I also keep track of the number I read on an e-reader and the number I read on paper.
Oh, yeah.
And over the last few years, that's actually been moving more towards the e-reader side.
Yeah.
Because of the time I was spending on trains.
Yeah.
Or travelling, not wanting to carry large volume and weight of books around with me, because when you finish one book, you want to be able to go on and read something else, especially if you're traveling.
Yep.
And if you suddenly realize that you bought 3 books with you and you've read them all, and your traveling partner goes, I don't want to read those, you have to read these, and you go, I don't want to read those, you're left with not knowing what you can do. So carrying an e-reader, especially when you're traveling, is absolutely perfect.
Yep.
You can line up 20, 30, 50, 100 books if you like, and you're never going to be without a choice. So over the last few years, because I've been more in transit more, I've been getting more towards the e-reader end. So in 2019, it was 66 to 43 out of 109 that I read in 2019. That's 66 for e-reader, 43 on paper. This year, it was 60 for the e-reader and 59 on paper. So pretty much.
Oh, okay. Much better. Much more level balance, yeah.
Level balance. So that's interesting. I only read 18 books that you could consider to be literary or non-genre this year, well, other than non-fiction. In the genre categories, I've got 58 I identified as SF, 13 as fantasy, one as a combination of the two because it was an anthology of science fiction and fantasy, and four horror novels, or four horror books, because I think one of the few of them was a novella. And in fact, I read, breaking it down to the type of book, there were 84 novels, 19 novellas, 10 collections, that's single author collections, one anthology, and five non-fiction. Now, normally in the past, I'd been reading a lot more anthologies, probably half a dozen more during the year. Again, that was because I was of the way I would travel on trains. And when you've got 15, 20 minutes on a train, perfect time to read a short story. You can get through it and you can finish it in the time that it takes to get to work, and you can sit and think about it and then walk off to work, listen to a podcast or something along those lines. Maybe read something at lunchtime and read something on the way home. So if you're doing a novel reading at night when you're traveling to and from work, you can get through three short stories in a day, or two longer stories. And this starts to add up. If you utilize your time properly, it starts to add up. Unfortunately, I'm not doing that the way I should be now, because I've got a completely new pattern that I have to try and get used to. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. What I guess basically comes down to is that setting myself targets helps me to, keeps me online. Now, the other thing that you were talking about in terms of rereading, and we were doing a lot of rereading or reading older books for the podcast. I of the 119 books I read this year, I read 28, which I'd read previously. So this was old, old Heinlein's, Simak stuff, all that stuff we've been talking about through the year, and that's been interesting. Though the bulk of those, I don't think I'll ever go back to again. Maybe one or two, because some of the ones that we read, of course, were for our favourite novels or favourite books of all time.
True.
And if I'm still kicking in 10 years, maybe I'll be able to get back to those and reread those again and still enjoy them. So they'll be probably about the only ones, though, that I get back to of the ones I've previously read. Anyway, there we go. So that's my overall view about where we got to. I missed a lot of targets. Like I said, I only set myself a target of six books in translation and read three. So that's pretty poor. But I know next year, do more. I've read one in translation already. Although that was only a Maigret novel. But it's
No, it's
still
a
in
translation.
translation.
That's fine.
Still in translation.
Sure.
Set in Holland. So, it's always good to have books set in different countries as
Yeah,
well.
that's true.
And so things that you have to think about. Yeah, so just to keep us in mind about where we are. And so we've been talking about what it is we've been reading. So this particular episode of the podcast, David, we decided a while ago, because we did this last year about this time, and thought it was a good idea. And also I want to point out, this is about choosing our best books of the previous reading year. It's interesting that there's a lot of people that decide they get asked about what's your best books of the year. I think this is a marketing ploy for places and publishers and booksellers to be able to sell books for the Christmas market, which makes a lot of sense. But for you and I, it's not a good idea to choose your best books of the year in November, because there's still a whole month to
Well, that's
go. And one of my books, in fact, my favourite SF novel of the year, I read in mid-December. So you've got to realise that things can come in very, very late in the year. And so that's why we hold off until January to be able to do this, and I'm very comfortable about it. Plus, it also gives us, if we have this break from mid-December to mid-January, it gives me 3, 4 weeks in which to get my act together, to get all the numbers figured out and work out where I am and get a bit more of a feeling of the overview of the year. So,
Well,
David, do you want to lead us off then?
I was just going to say before we go on that you're right in that I actually read two of my best 10 books of the year I read since the last episode of the podcast.
Oh, okay.
So, it can be very late in the year that you get to some of the really good books.
And you don't want to You don't want to discard those because those sometimes are the ones that you really want to do a lot of thinking about.
Well, that's right. In fact, both of those really I need to reread before I talk about them at any great length, but we'll see.
All right. Is that going to go into your rereads for next year then?
Oh, I'm not sure. I'm not sure I keep track of that. But anyway, okay, so we're going to go roll on now, and I'll tell you about the best five anyway. SF books that I've read for the first time. This is the other thing about the podcast. Because we're reading so much of the material that we've previously read in the past, I sort of separated out the books that I've read for the first time and the books that I read again in this SF category, because it didn't really apply to the other categories. So I have sort of split them into those sort of two areas. And okay, so science fiction. So the top science fiction books I read for the first time. I'm going to go in reverse order and end up with the best. So the number five on my list was The Thing Itself by Adam Roberts, which was a very strange book we have discussed on the podcast, which was sort of all hanging off the idea of Immanuel Kant's Ding an sich, the thing itself, the sort of this philosophical concept that we don't get, really understand. We only get an impression of what the real world is like through our senses, and our senses are limited, and they shape what we actually see as reality. So it was an interesting book. It was very strange in places, but it was still a pretty good book, I thought. Number four on my list is Roadside Picnic by Arkady and Boris Strugatsky, which I'd read for the first time. I really need to go back and read some more Strugatsky's, I think. But that was pretty good. We read that in preparation to looking at the film Stalker, which is based on that film, on that book. But I enjoyed the book a lot more than I enjoyed the film, which we discussed on a particular episode of the podcast. Number three on my list was Touch by Claire North. Now, last year at this time, I was raving about how I really enjoyed the books of Claire North. But in fact, Touch was the only book of hers I managed to get to this year, so that's a bit of a pity. But and it wasn't, it's not quite as good as the other two books of hers that we've discussed, but it was still pretty good. I enjoyed it quite a bit. I won't go into great detail about it, but the premise, I suppose, is the idea that there are certain people who can transfer their whole souls, if you like, into someone else, as long as they're able to touch them, touch their skin, and they can get into their mind and control them, and with all their existing memories. So it's a clever concept, and she does it pretty well. So that was good. Number two on my list was Hothouse by Brian Aldiss, which I'd never read before, which I enjoyed quite a lot. It's this idea of a world far, far in the future when the Earth is, I think the Earth has become tidally locked to the sun, and the sun is starting to swell up into a red giant and become very hot, make everything very hot on the Earth. And so vegetation has kind of gone absolutely wild, and humanity is just this kind of little creature which has managed to survive in between these very dangerous plants that surround them. And number one on my list for science fiction for the year was Infinite Detail by Tim Maughan, which we discussed several episodes back. And again, I won't go into any great detail about that, I don't think, but that's set in the real premise of that is that the internet and also the computer systems that are tied to that have come down. There's something that's actually has got in there and broken down the internet, maybe by chance or maybe by deliberate intention. And so we're looking at the world as it might be after that kind of catastrophe happening to the internet. And so I thought that was pretty good. And Perry may have more to say about that one. I've got a number of honorable mentions. Time is the Simplest Thing by Clifford Simak, which is the first time I've read that. I enjoyed that a lot. The Second Sleep by Robert Harris, which had some problems towards the end, I thought, but it was pretty good. And Venus Plus X by Theodore Sturgeon, which I know Perry didn't much like, but that was one of the ones we read for the Hugo Time Machine. So that's my book SF books read for the first time. How about yours, Perry?
Thanks, David. One of yours appears on mine, so we'll gradually get to that. Again, I'll do mine in reverse order, as you've done. So number five is Ghost Species by James Bradley, Chong and I had a big discussion about this during the year, sometime around about September or so. It's the only Australian SF novel on my list. I thought it's an excellent book. The idea being that there is a tech entrepreneur who is attempting to recreate a member of the Neanderthal species. And the story goes about why he does this. Well, not so much why he does it, but the outcomes of him succeeding in creating a Neanderthal child. Excellent book. One of the major news, The Guardian had this as one of their 2020 best Australian novels. So that's a big plus for it. Number four, The 10,000 Doors of January by Alex E. Harrow. Discussed this early last year because it got a lot of buzz in 2019 when it came out, and it was nominated for a number of awards but didn't win any, I don't think. A good book, a good portal fantasy. Enjoyed that one quite a lot. Number three, A Memory Called Empire by Arkady Martin. This won the Hugo Award and was nominated for a few others, including The Nebula. Excellent book, written in 2019. The sequel was supposed to come out last year, but didn't because of all the upheavals in the publishing industry caused by COVID-19. I believe that the sequel is out sometime in 2020, and I'm certainly looking forward to that. It's a Galactic Empire space opera-ish thing.
Okay.
That's about all I can say, because to go into it in great detail, it's going to take a little bit of time. But anyway, number two, Infinite Details by Tim Maughan. How about that? Now, this was inexplicably ignored by all the major awards in 2020, except for the Locus First Novel Award, and it didn't win that one either.
Oh, well.
So that's a bit of a nuisance. So, bit of a pity. I thought it was the best of the 2019 books. I think I might have mentioned at some stage when we read it at the beginning of last year that I was hoping that it was going to do well in the Clark Award. And I believe from a friend of ours, Justin Aykroyd, I think he told me that it wasn't even submitted.
Wow.
And you've got to wonder why the heck that was. You really do. I don't quite get that.
No.
But my best novel of the year, read in the middle of December by your all-time favourite SF author, Kim Stanley Robinson.
Not so much. Yes, go on.
No, not so much. I know that's why it's called The Ministry of the Future. Now, this is Robinson's latest book, published quite late in the year, October-ish. And it's an optimistic novel about the world's fight against climate change and its impacts. It's set in the 2030s, and for my opinion, this is the best SF novel of the year. I very much doubt whether anybody else will agree with me. I don't think it's going to get nominated for. It might get nominated for the Hugo, for the Nebula. I don't think it, I think the Hugo Award, the Hugo nominees, voters will ignore it. It's a big, sprawling one, reminiscent a bit of Stand on Zanzibar and John Dos Passos's USA, in the sense that it's got bits and pieces of small chapters. And some of these chapters are weird. They're written from a number of different points of view. Some of them read like ancient riddles, and told from the points of view of such items as a photon, the sun, history, in inverted commas, history, the financial market, and a carbon atom,
All right.
as well as a number of human beings.
Yeah, interesting.
And you can actually get a bit of an indication and a bit of a learning about what blockchain is, because I sure as hell don't know. And this actually helped me to understand it, but I have to go back and read it again. Now, nobody in the field writes like Robinson at all, and nobody writes like this. And to be perfectly frank, I don't think anybody could. This is a massive novel of ideas. It's almost like, here's a blueprint and a way forward if you want to take it. And I would say that if you don't read this book, you won't know what modern SF is capable of. I've been discussing this, as I mentioned earlier, with Ghost Species, and we had a discussion with Chong about this, so I'm going to put him on the spot here and say that we are going to be having a chat about this, which we will record and play on the podcast in a month or so, about this particular book. He's read it, I've read it, I gave this one 4.8 out of 5, David.
Very good
and that's
score.
That's a very high score for me,
yeah,
but I thought it was excellent.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I'm certainly planning to read it. And I noticed that one of the lists of, you know, best books of 2020, one of the people who I do have a very close look at their recommendations is a certain gentleman called Barack Obama. I don't know whether you've heard of him. Mm-hmm. And he puts out his list every year of the books, the best books he's read during the year. And that book is actually on his list, together with a number of others that I've either read or will be looking at. So, he obviously thought it was pretty good.
A couple of honourable mentions for you. If you snuck a couple in, I'll best give you before you jump ahead. Gideon the Ninth, this one, by Thames and Muir, this one, the Locust First Novel Award, and A Song for a New Day by Sarah Pinsker, which was the Debula Award winner for in 2020 for a novel published in 2019. Part of the problem we're talking about here, David, is that we're talking about books that were actually published 2 years ago.
Yep.
I'm talking about books that were possibly published up to 2 years ago, but which we only read last year, because we take a while to catch up.
That's right.
And that's fine.
Indeed. All right, well, so now I'm going to look at the science fiction books I read for the second or third or fourth time, I suppose, in some cases. So number five on my list was The Dragon Masters by Jack Vance, which is more of a novella, really, than a novel, but nevertheless, it's an excellent work of science fiction. Number four was Way Station by Clifford Simak, which won the Hugo in the year that we were discussing when we did the Hugo Time Machine back then. I can't remember which year it was, but that's an excellent book, and I won't go into any detail because Perry and I both thought it was a great novel and actually won the Hugo that year. Next on my list, which came up in my list of best books of all time when we did that particular episode, was The Stars My Destination by Alfred Bester, which, it's not a perfect novel. I mean, all these books are not necessarily the best written books of all time, but they're the things which appeal to us and we enjoyed. And so The Stars My Destination, rereading that was very enjoyable. Number two on my list was Solaris by Stanislaw Lem, which again we talked about a fair bit on the podcast and then talked about the films based on it. And my number one in my list of SF books read for the second or for third or fourth time, number one on my list was A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller Jr., which again we talked about a fair bit on an episode of the podcast. And I won't go into any great detail, but it's a great post-apocalyptic novel where the lost knowledge has really been kept as it was in the Middle Ages by monasteries and by monks recopying works from the past. And so they preserved the knowledge, scientific knowledge from the past, which then eventually comes back to bite them, and the fact that they've managed to recover that knowledge. So that's my, I don't have any honourable mentions in that category, so that's my bit for that.
I read 14 of these during the year, and so actually a lot of them, eight all up I'm going to mention, so 8 out of 14's not bad. My first... number five for me was Dune World by Frank Herbert. I really enjoyed this first part of it. I thought it was a cracking part. I think it's probably going to take up about the first third of the complete Dune, and we'll be covering Dune in our next Hugo Time Machine for the Hugo Awards of 1966. It's probably the basis for the upcoming film, which is another good reason to probably get out and have a read of it before then. But anyway, Dune itself is a classic in the field. Even if you don't necessarily like it, I think you basically have to tackle it at least once. Number four, Way Station by Clifford D. Simak or Simak. Again, we both agree that it's a wonderfully quiet, excellent novel. Hugo winner for the year. Number three, The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick. Another Hugo winner for that particular year. Wonderful book. To me, it's different from what Phil Dick was doing in a lot of other stuff. You know, I know it's sort of episodic, this particular book, but it's not as frenetic, or not as just, it's not as weird as a lot of other things where you get there and you think, what the hell is going on? This at least you can follow it through, for me anyway. Number two, Cadigal for Leibowitz. Doesn't get to number one for me for Walter Red Miller Jr., another Hugo Award winner. As you rightly said, an excellent book, another one that needs to be read. And number one for me, because it came up as my best science fiction novel of all time, is The Left Hand of Darkness by Ursula K. Le Guin, winner of the Hugo Nebula Awards in 1970. And we discussed this in our first anniversary episode of this particular podcast. This is a major work in the history of the field. Whether you like it or loathe it, the field changed after this particular book was written, and suddenly it became much easier for people to be able to express a particular point of view and deal with political and issues of genre, which up until then had been sort of, nobody really cared terribly much. But this was the one that, for me at least, maybe other historians will, oh, I'm not a historian, but other reviewers will say something different. For me at least, this was the big change. Honourable mentions, Solaris, which you've already talked about, by Stanislaw Lem.
That's Lof, I
Lof,
believe.
Lof, I said as Lof Lem.
Stand to his friends, as you said in the
Yeah, stand to his
episode.
mates. That's about all we can do. Roadside Picnic by Arkady and Boris Stragatsky. Yeah, very interesting book. And yeah, I agree with you. I think I need to go back and have a look a bit more at the Stragatsky boys. There's some interesting stuff there. And the other honourable mention for me was The Planet Buyer by Cordwainer Smith. Maybe novella, maybe long novella. Half of his final fixed up book, Nostralia, and an excellent book. And that's me.
Very good. So now we roll on to fantasy. I believe that last year I didn't have a fantasy category. I put them all together with science fiction. Can't remember. Anyway, so this year at least I separate out the fantasy books that that I've read. So my top, in fact, it's kind of a bit of a, what would you say? I'm sort of cheating a bit because three out of my top five are all really part of one trilogy. So I'm kind of cheating, but without that, I don't have five fantasy books. So my top five fantasy books. Number five was Silver by Vercors. Now we talked about this on the podcast when we did that particular year. I can't remember now whether it was 1961 or 63, something like that. That it was up for the Hugo. And it's a very strange book in that the premise is that this bloke is out in the field and there's a fox being chased by a hunt, and the fox eventually turns into a naked young woman, which is bizarre. But if you accept this sort of bizarre premise, the rest of the book's really quite interesting. It was because it's really about how this bloke takes this creature, this arrived, this fox in human shape, which is just being created, and manages to educate her up to become like a real human. And but the whole course of that development is really really quite an interesting book. So it was a real surprise to me. Didn't expect to like it at all, but I did. So it's number five on my list. And the next three books are really all part of the Lioness trilogy by Jack Vance. And so the books in that trilogy are Lioness, The Green Pearl, and Madook. And that's a terrific, terrific fantasy trilogy. And everybody should read it who's interested in the fantasy field, I think. And number one on my list, that Perry will be not at all surprised to find, was Piranesi by Susanna Clarke, which again I talked about a fair bit on the podcast, so I won't go into any great detail about it. But this fascinating concept of this bloke who is living in this vast, apparently endless series of halls, this huge house, he calls it the house, endless series of ruined halls, and with the basement of which is flooded regularly by tides, and the upper levels of which are constantly filled with clouds. And he's the whole there's a whole mystery about how where he is, how he came to be there, what's going to happen. And I enjoyed it enormously. It's one of my top books of all time, I think. And I'll come back to it again. I've read it twice last year, I don't have any. I don't have any honorable mentions for that. So that's my fantasy category.
Okay, I only read six fantasy novels for this year, so I'm not giving a top five because otherwise I'd, and an honorable mention, otherwise I'd mention the whole bloody lot.
Yeah, well, that's
And
right.
there's some of them that I didn't want to mention at all, so I won't do that. I think this is mainly because, as you pointed out earlier, most of the work that we were doing for the podcast dealt with either science fiction concepts or the Hugo time machine. And during the early to middle part of the 1960s, the vast bulk of the novels that appeared on the Hugo ballots were science fiction novels by middle-aged white males. And so I'm not denigrating with middle-aged white males, David, given that we
No.
are two representatives of that, although we're probably at the upper end of the middle-aged part of it. But I still feel middle-aged. But we're not, I wasn't reading much in the way of fantasy during the year. So I've only got three. So my number three was top five, but this is actually top three. Number three, Middle Game by C-Nan McGuire. This was nominated for the Hugo Award. It won the Locus Fantasy Award during the year. Talked about this a bit on the podcast. It's one of those ones about it's another work by Maguire where she's concentrating on the powers of children. It's a long work, deserved to be on this particular list, I think. I think it is a very competent, well-written novel, just not up to the level of the next couple that came through. My number two, Piranesi, by Susanna Clarke, which you have mentioned, so I won't go into any of that detail. I very much enjoyed this book. And yes, I do think it does deserve another reread in a short period of time. It's one of those ones that goes into your head and bounces around a bit, and then you think, hang on a minute, I better go back and reread this again. So if it does that, and you're still sitting there and everything, and you go, oh, and it's something about the particular book pops up in your head months later, time for you to go back and have a look at it, I think. And my number one, which is one that I hadn't read before, but I'm working through this, is Voices by Ursula K. Le Guin. So she gets two number ones. This is volume two of the Annals of the Western Shore, originally published as a YA novel, and it can be read as such because one of the main protagonists is a young teenage girl who's it's a coming of age story in a sense where she slowly comes to the realization that she is going to be given a great burden, in that she is going to be tasked with looking after the library of her country because the country in which she is living has been invaded by the neighbors next door who are fearful of the written word and think that it is evil, even though they are great lovers of the oral storytelling tradition. And so this is Le Guin's fantasy version of her novel from the Haynes universe, The Telling, which again, if you haven't read, I suggest you go out and do so. And it's also got a lot of puts back, connections through to Bradbury's Fahrenheit 451. This is a very fine novel indeed. This is a very fine series. I've got one more to go and I'm sort of eking it out, David. You know how you get those series and you think, I don't really want it to end, but I know I've only got one left. She only wrote three in this particular series, so I've got one more to go. So I'll get to that sometime this year, which will probably mean it's very high up in my fantasy novels of next year.
Indeed.
Due to the fact that I only read six, I've got no honourable mentions in this one at all.
Fair enough, fair enough. All right, now for some reason this year I decided to break out alternate history as a separate category. I'm not quite sure why I did that, but I did anyway because we had a particular episode where we talked about alternate history novels, and really all of these books are from that from reading for that particular episode. And I've only got four, so I'll go through these very quickly because, as I say, it's kind of strange to have as a separate category. Alternate history just seems to me to be not quite science fiction,
Okay.
and it's not certainly not quite fantasy. It's sort of, you could argue either way
Yeah.
what it is, but I suppose if you want to think about parallel timelines, maybe Maybe it's more science fiction in that sense. But anyway, for whatever reason, I broke it out as a separate category. So number four on my list was Dominion by C.J. Sansom, which is a novel set in Britain after the Second World War, a Second World War in which England essentially capitulated. Well, it didn't capitulate, but they decided not to go against the Germans when the Germans started invading Poland and so on. And so it's set really in a Britain which is being very heavily influenced by the Nazi government, which is now in place in Germany. Third one on my list was Fatherland by Robert Harris, which again is another novel set where the Nazis won the Second World War. But it's also a crime novel. Very well done, I thought. Number two on my list was Bring the Jubilee by Ward Moore, which is actually a Civil War alternate history, which was kind of almost the granddaddy of that particular genre of the alternate civil history where the South wins the Civil War, the Confederates win the Civil War. I thought that was excellent, but excellent for mainly because it's really, there's some really interesting character works, very interesting from that point of view, and rather than the actual twist at the end about how the two timelines became separate. And number one on my list, as you'd guess, is The Man in the High Castle by Philip K. Dick, which, again, we've talked about so much that there's no reason to talk about again. So that's my list there. So I'll throw it back to you, Perry. I think you're going to now take over with crime, is that right?
Yes, I didn't split my alternate history books out. They've been included in the others. But we all have to look at the way we read slightly differently, but I'll move on to crime books for the year. I read 13, which is probably less than I would normally read, again due to the number of SF novels we read for the podcast. Hopefully in 2021 we can get a bit more of a balance here, yeah. David. But again, being able to track what we did last year gives us a better idea of where we need to put the balance. I'd like to read a few more crime novels. It is a genre I really like. My number five, The Ruin by Dervla McTiernan. This is the first in her series of Cormac O'Reilly novels set in Galway in Ireland. Dervla McTiernan is a ex-Irish citizen who moved to Perth to live in about 2008, around about the time of the GFC. As you recall, Ireland just basically pretty much went almost belly up, and she left there to come out and work in Perth, has stayed, moved into writing, and is now pretty much writing full time, I think. This Cormac O'Reilly series is certainly worth your time to have a bit of a look at. I know it seems strange to have her as an Australian author, but she is writing here, even though her setting is in Ireland. Number four, Beat Not the Bones by Charlotte Jay. I discussed this in on the podcast. This was a novel that won a major award way back in the 1950s. It's a crime novel of a sorts, set in Papua New Guinea, written by a woman, set in Papua New Guinea, very rare, and quite an excellent book that deserves a bit more attention than it's received. Number three, The Good Turn by Dervla McTiernan, number three in the series. I actually thought the third was better than the first. I think I've discussed why, in the sense that I thought that in the first two, I really figured that the books could have been set anywhere. And that was, I mean, it's a very small nit to pick, isn't it, David? When I basically come out and sort of say, but the one thing about crime novels, which I'll come to when I get to number one in this, the one thing about crime novels is setting and character and plot.
Yes.
And if your setting could be anywhere, it's got nothing really to distinguish it. This one, at least in number three, I believe that she has really gone back to thinking about Ireland and thinking about the landscape of Ireland, and she's utilised that a heck of a lot more in that particular novel than she did in the first two. And for that reason, it ended up as my number three as opposed to number five.
Sure.
Number two, Strangers on a Train by Patricia Highsmith, one of the all-time crime classics made into a film by Alfred Hitchcock. Very dark, and it's her first novel. Patricia Highsmith also wrote the Ripley novels, and she had a very, very dark view of the human nature. It's a very interesting book to read and see what people were doing back in the 1950s, when everybody thought this stuff really has only come through since the serial killer burst through in the 70s. That sort of stuff. Nah, this is dark, but excellent with it. And my number one, Peace by Gary Disher. This is number two in the series of crime novels set in the mid-north of South Australia. I discussed this with Lucy Sussex in the middle of, or the beginning, first quarter of the year on the podcast. Dish is in top form here, probably the best crime writer in the country. He's now probably the great, if you want to call him that, he probably would hate you to say this, but he's the sort of the granddaddy of Australian crime fiction at the moment, with Kerry Fisher as being the other part of the grandmother, if you like. Both of them have been around since the 1980s and are still writing, and writing very, very well. Everything by Disher is good. There's a new one out called Consolation, which I got for Christmas, and I'm sitting there thinking, I've got to get to this. I've got to get to this sooner or later. And hopefully I'll get to this in the next month and a half, so that we can discuss it when we come to our next crime fiction podcast, which will be coming up sometime in the first quarter. So they are my top five. The honourable mentions: Raven Black by Anne Cleves. This is the first in her Shetland series of novels. Fatherland by Robert Harris, his first novel in an alternate history that we discussed about. And this is at a time where the Nazis have won the Second World War, and absolutely nobody is aware of certain things that the Nazis did during the Second World War, and what happens when that information starts to come out in the 1960s. And the third one, so it just goes to show you that probably last year you had Claire North. I reckon this year my discovery was Dervla McTiernan, because my third one is the second book in the series for Cormac O'Reilly, called or Cormac Riley, I should say, The Scholar by Dervla McTiernan.
Okay.
So she did very well for me for the year. David?
All right, so I found this a really, really tough category to pick the best from. I'd read quite a few crime books during the year, and they were almost all of them were bloody good. So it was hard to pick a best five, but I'm going to have a go. So number five on my list was The Good Turn by Dervla McTiernan. So we're in agreement that we like her books a lot. I think I enjoyed that. I think that I'd re previously read in 2019, I'd read her first two books. So they didn't get Guernsey here, but I did read The Good Turn this year, and I did think it was excellent. Number four on my list was The Broken Shore by Peter Temple. And so Peter Temple has been a bit of a discovery for me this year. I hadn't read any of his other books before I read The Broken Shore. It's excellent. This one's set in Australia, and very much the sense of place there. Number three on my list was The Searcher by Tana French. I raved last episode, I think, about how much I enjoy Tana French's work. She's an American-born person who now lives in Ireland, has been living in Ireland for quite a long time now, 20 years or so. And all of her books are set in Ireland. Most of them have been set around Dublin, but this one is a different one, which is set really in the west of Ireland. But I really enjoyed that. I talked about it quite a lot last episode. Number two on my list was Gone by Midnight by Candice Fox. That's the third in her Crimson Lake series, all of which are excellent. Gone by Midnight was really good, I thought, and it's set in northern Queensland, and it's got crocodiles and swamps, and very clever bit of plotting. I thought it really, really held my attention, and I wasn't sure at all how it was going to come out. Very clever stuff. And number one on my list was Truth by Peter Temple, another one by Peter Temple. And this is the book of his which won the Miles Franklin Award in a particular year. And again, it's very much a crime novel, but really excellent characterization. Very much very detailed setting, set in Melbourne, and great, great book. Certainly, you know, certainly easily the top of my list. But it was hard to stop my honourable mentions from spilling out and becoming a huge long list. So, but because I really did read a lot of really good crime books during the year. So the honourable mentions, I've only got a few really, but I'm only prepared to let myself have a few. The honourable mentions are The Survivors by Jane Harper, another great Australian crime writer. Resurrection Bay by Emma Viskic, first of her books I've read, another good Australian crime writer. Good Girl, Bad Girl by Michael Rowbotham, who's an Australian but mostly sets his books in England. In fact, all of his books, I think, have been set in England. Good Girl, Bad Girl is really the first of a new series with a character called Cyrus Haven. And I went straight on and read the sequel to this, which is called When She Was Good. And really, the two books together are almost, you know, almost a one book. But I didn't read When She Was Good until the beginning of this year, so I can't talk about it in the list of last year's books. And the last honourable mention I had is Bad Debts by Peter Temple, which is the first of his Jack Irish books. And people may well know Jack Irish through the TV series featuring Guy Pearce, which I hadn't watched. But Bad Debts was pretty good. It wasn't great, but it was still pretty good. I'm looking forward to reading the rest of the Jack Irish books. So that's my crime slash thriller.
Interesting to note, isn't it, that we've all got a lot of Australian authors on that list.
Oh, yeah.
So there's a lot of damn good Australian crime fiction coming out. So,
oh, yeah, it certainly is.
We'll be concentrating a bit more on that during the year, because there's a few others that are starting to pop up and people are talking about, which we need to keep on top of, because let me tell you, they're very prolific, these new authors. You know, they seem to have a few tricks up their sleeve, and they just basically keep on putting them out there. Okay, so moving on to our next category of literary or non-genre. We're lumping this together. We're not talking non-fiction here, because we'll cover that a bit separately later on. But this is particular works that we can't put into any of the previous categories, if you like, or even a couple of the others coming up. But it's a major one that we deal with. Now, I read 17 books that I would consider to be literary during the year. Again, not enough. Again, subservient to the number of SF novels that we read. Anyway, number 5, Heatwave in Berlin by Dimfna Kuzak. I think I discussed this on the podcast. This is about set in the early 1960s, a young Australian couple and their daughter go to Germany. He emigrated to Australia, to Sydney, after the Second World War, and married his wife. Well, as you do, but you married the female character. I was trying to work out how to put that. Married the female main character, and they're travelling back to Germany to see his mother, who they believe is unwell, when they find out that she isn't. And it's all a ruse to basically try and get him to come back and take over the family business, which is very much trying to restore the fascist regime into Germany in the 1960s. An excellent neglected book by a neglected writer, and I'll have to be trying to catch up on Kuzak's work, because there's a number more that I need to read. Number 4, another Australian novel by another neglected woman writer, The Women in Black by Madeleine St. John.
Oh, I'm looking forward to reading that, yeah.
Oh, this is brilliant. This is really good, this one. Made into a film recently called Ladies in Black by Bruce Beresford. Oddly enough, you find out that Bruce Beresford actually went to university with Madeleine St. John, but they split apart. She got married young and went and lived in the US. He moved to Britain with people like Clive James and Robert Hughes and Germaine Greer. And so she was of that particular ilk. This was her first novel written when she was in her early 50s. It's a cracker. It's really, really good. And it's No, it's just good. I'll have to talk about it later on, I think. I don't think I've talked about it in the podcast yet.
I saw that Hilary Mantel recommended it, and that's why I went out and bought a copy. I haven't read it yet, but that's a pretty good recommendation too for me.
Great minds think alike, David. That's all I could say. Number three, The Rain Heron by Robbie Arnott. This didn't get as much accolades in Australia as it should have, I thought. A lot of people. I discussed this when we did our genre adjacent books, this one and The Animals in That Country, which was also an excellent novel. I don't think that one was to this standard because I think Arnott's a better writer. I think McKay in the other book bit off a fair bit, and I think it sort of didn't quite come together as well as it might at the end, but this one does. And I think this one, he's another writer to keep an eye on, this Robbie Arnott. Number two, A Month in the Country by J.L. Carr. I don't know if you know this particular book. It's only
No.
a very short book, novella length, probably 125, 130 pages, set just after the First World War. And it tells the story of a bloke called Tom Birkin, who's arrived in this small village to restore a newly discovered medieval mural, which has been found in a local church. He's suffering some problems from the First World War, a bit of, we would now say, post-traumatic stress disorder. I'm not sure when this book was written, probably in the 60s, maybe 70s. Short book, reminded me of The Return of the Soldier by Rebecca West, which is also another excellent book about soldiers returning from the First World War. Also short, but therefore they're written from a woman's point of view about the soldier. This is written looking at the particular soldier that comes to do this work in the church because he's using this as a means of healing. Beautifully written stuff. And my favourite for the year, as you might expect, because it was in my all-time favourites in our anniversary issue last year, was The French Lieutenant's Woman by John Fowles.
All right.
My all-time favourite novel, can't talk about this more than what we've already done because I rabbited on about this at great length in that anniversary issue, anniversary podcast. But it's a beautifully written postmodern novel that deals with the moral of the cloistered Victorian era, women standing in society, and throws in the Pre-Raphaelites as a little bit of an extra right at the very end. This is an exceptional book. Absolutely adore it. Won't hear a word against it, and I will never go and watch the film adaptation, as I think I might have said,
You
because
have.
it would ruin everything. Honourable mentions for the year, two Australians. A Superior Spectre by Angela Meyer, which again I talked about in that adjacent genre adjacent episode, and the other one, The Animals in That Country, which I just mentioned by Laura Jean McKay. Both of those should be sought out and read. There's some very good authors working in interesting connections and interesting parts of the genre and literary and crossovers, if you want to call that. If you take that Venn diagram and that there's little bits in the middle where they cross over, that's where these people are working, and it's interesting work being done.
Yeah, absolutely. It's hard to know what to call this category, isn't it? I've got literary slash non-genre slash uncategorized, but it's basically anything we can't stick anywhere else. But it's almost it is almost a thing in itself, though, isn't it? It's really is. It's books which, it's really about the writing, and they may have elements of the genres that we're interested in, may have elements of fantasy, may have elements of crime, but nevertheless, it's not, they're books that wouldn't be published under that genre category in a bookstore. You wouldn't see them under that category in a bookstore. So, and I also want to say that this category, followed by crime, but this category was, like, if you were voting on categories for the year, this is the best. These are the best books I read in the year. We're almost all in this category. So, the top five. Number five on my list was Colorless Tsukuru Tazaki and His Years of Pilgrimage by Haruki Murakami. Terrific, really interesting book about this bloke who was part of a close group of friends, and they reject him when he goes to college, and he doesn't understand why they've completely rejected him and don't want to speak to him again. And it's a mystery which lasts through decades of his life, and before he goes back to really try to figure out what it was that went wrong with the relationship with these people. Really nicely done. Number four on my list is Human Croquet by Kate Atkinson. I've said before that Kate Atkinson is another one of my really favorite authors, and I really enjoyed rereading Human Croquet. Strange book in all sorts of ways, but it has one of those books which has got a really interesting narrator, young girl or young woman, and she comments very ironically on her surroundings, on her neighbors, on her family, which has got some strange things which have happened to her family. And then strange things start happening in her world. She starts seeing or experiencing the past in interesting ways. Very cleverly done. Liked it a lot. Enjoyed rereading it a lot. The next book on my list was a book I read since the last podcast. I think Perry got me onto this. Now I can't remember quite how we got onto it, but we looked at it and saw a review of it, and it sounded weird but interesting. And it's called The Sunken Land Has Begun to Rise Again by M. John Harrison. Now, I've read nothing by him before. I think this may be his first novel. He's got some short stories out.
No, he's written a number of other novels in the past. Light was a big one. He wrote a trilogy of novels in the 20 early 2010s, maybe even the early 2000s. And he's been
Okay.
around for a fair while, and he's written a fair number of short fiction.
Well, I must go back then and read some of his other books.
I think there's a lot in his bibliography.
It's very hard to describe this book. The Sunken Land Has Begun to Rise Again. It features two individuals who are pretty ordinary sort of individuals, but they come into contact, begin a relationship. But it's really about what happens to them, their relationships with, in each case, their parents or their mother. Just odd things start to happen, and they experience these things, and they absolutely do not understand what is going on. I'm going to have to talk about this at length on the podcast in the future, because it's impossible to describe simply. But odd things start to happen that they're both involved in two different places, I can't do at all a decent job of summarizing it, but it's excellent. It's well worth reading. I'm going to reread it. I'm going to re-read it for a second time, and in a future episode I may sit down and discuss this with someone. I think you said that Lucy thought it was good, and I might sit down and talk to her about it if she's willing. Anyway, so definitely recommend it anyway. Number two on my list is a book that I'd been hearing about for years, because I think it came out in the 60s, 1960s. But it's called We Have Always Lived in the Castle by Shirley Jackson. Have you read this?
No,
It's
I'm another blind spot, Shirley Jackson.
I've just discovered Shirley Jackson basically through this book. I'm in the middle of reading another book by her called The Haunting of Hill House.
Yep,
But
that's her classic.
yeah, and that's like a horror. I haven't got to the end of it yet, so I'm not going to
No, I
give
haven't read
anything
that
away.
either, so don't worry about it. I can't give you any spoilers on that one,
Yeah,
David.
but We Have Always Lived in the Castle is a wonderful book, but it's also about it's kind of it's about a tragedy, a family tragedy when you look at it objectively. But it's all written from the first person point of view of this character called what is it? Let me just get this exactly right. Her first name. I'll read the first paragraph of the book because it's well worth considering the first paragraph. She says, "My name is Mary Kathleen Blackwood. I am 18 years old and I live with my sister Constance. I've often thought that with any luck at all, I could have been born a werewolf because the two middle fingers of both my hands are the same length. But I have to be content with what I had. I dislike washing myself and dogs and noise. I like my sister Constance and Richard Plantagenet and Amanita Falodes, the death cup mushroom. Everyone else in my family is dead." And you sort of read that, and I think some people have treated this book as though it were kind of slightly more serious Addams Family, but it's absolutely not. There's actually absolutely no fantasy elements in the story at all. But what is very, very interesting is this character, Mary Kathleen, who her sister calls Mary Cat. So almost throughout the book, her sister refers to her as Mary Cat. And there's been a tragedy in the past, as you slowly come to understand this. Again, I've got to talk about this at length on the podcast some other time. But there's been a tragedy in the past. 6 years previously, the majority of her family have died through being poisoned. They're all at the dinner table, and they're having dessert, and someone has introduced arsenic into the sugar. So they're sprinkling the sugar onto their berries or whatever the dessert is, and they eat them, and the majority of them die from arsenic poisoning. So this has happened 6 years previously, and her sister Constance was put on trial. She wishes, because 6 years previously, obviously Mary Cat was 12, and her sister I think is about 10 years older than her, so it would have been about 22. It's a wonderful book. It's a very short book. Again, a book I have to read for a second time, but very, very much recommended. And I say I'm now going to go and read as much else by Shirley Jackson as I can find. So I seem to have talked more about number three and number two than I'm going to talk about number one on my list, which is Normal People by Sally Rooney, an Irish writer. It's been made into a television series, I think. It's about these two young people in Ireland and their ongoing on again off again relationship. And I talked about it early in the year in the podcast, so I won't go into any detail about it. But it's really excellent. It certainly was right to be first on my list. Honourable mentions: The Blind Contessa's New Machine by Carey Walz, which I talked about on the podcast. The Plains by Gerald Manane, which we never actually got around to talking about on the podcast. We must do that someday. The Tenant of Wildfell Hall by Anne Bronte, classic English literature. I hadn't read anything by Anne Bronte before. I'd read some of her sister's work, Charlotte. What's the other? Emily Bronte.
Emily.
Emily and Charlotte Bronte. But I'd never read anything by Anne. But I thought that was excellent. I actually did that as a production for Standard eBooks, which is why I came to read it. But I thought it was really good. So that's my literary area.
Okay, now we're all going to. I'm now going to move on to another category that I know that David hasn't listed, but he snuck in alternate history earlier on, so I feel justified about putting
Sure.
this one in. In fact, then I think we jumped to a few that the other one hasn't really covered much. So this one is the Single Author Collections. Generally, what happens is we do a lot of reading of shorter fiction during the year for the Hugo Time Machine, and so it is sometimes worth your while to pick up the short story collection that those particular stories are collected within, and to see what else the author's doing at and around that time. Now, I'd normally read a fair number of these during the year. I read 10, as it happens, during this particular year. So that's normally about the number that I get through. But unfortunately, while there might have been one or two stories in each collection which were sort of okay, most of them read as if they were just, well, this guy's got five or six stories, let's plug them all into one volume, don't really care. This is more a matter of people missed them when they came out in the magazine publications, so therefore we'll put them into a collection. It's not a best of, it's just this is how many stories he's got, makes up a book, let's put it out. In general, those don't work all that well, and as the case here, that is pretty much what happened, because most of the ones that I read were by authors who had published these collections in the 1960s. That's what happened back then. Now, so the only one of these that I can recommend, so it comes in at number one, is A Rose for Ecclesiastes by Roger Zelazny. Now, this is a collection of four short works from Zelazny from pretty much his most creative period, from about 63 to 66. The top there's the title story, which we discussed on the podcast. The doors of his face, the lamps of his mouth, which is coming up in the next Hugo Awards time, Hugo Time Machine that we're going to be discussing. See, I'm covering both ends. I've got one that I've already read, and now I'm picking up this one that I need to read later on. There was two others in it. So both Rosa Ecclesiastes and The Doors of His Face, etc., were on the Hugo ballots in their prospective years, but unfortunately neither of them won, although Doors of His Face does actually win a Nebula Award, but we'll get to that. Now, both of these particular stories show Zelazny at his best, and they do deserve to be reread. I'm not saying they're the greatest thing ever done, but you have to look at them in context, and in context they were pretty astounding. If you read this collection, you get a really good view of what he was like in the early part of his journey as a writer, when his style and voice were starting to come together, and it stands out. It does stand out. So he was in he was in and around that time when people like Cordwainer Smith were really rolling, and Harlan Ellison was kicking off into his sort of a newer period, because Ellison had been writing some stuff in the 50s, but it really wasn't until he gets into the 60s that he really starts going. So Zelazny was one of those good ones around that time. I got one honourable mention, which normally wouldn't have been rated highly enough to get in to my honourable mentions in a normal bit, but I really want to mention this one. It's Murder and Magic by Randall Garrett.
Oh, yes.
These are his first collection of four or five of his Lord Darcy series of alternate history stories. Need to discuss this at some time on the podcast, because this is a very interesting view of how magic can actually look like science. You know, sometimes you say that science looks like magic, but this is an instance where magic looks like science.
Mm.
And these are basically murder mysteries.
Mm.
And so there's a really nice combination of genres going on here.
Yeah.
I love this stuff. Always have.
Yeah, they're very good. Yeah.
They're very good. Always go back. I mean, I know they're, but I mean, you could basically say, you know, they're just pastiches of Holmes and Watson. Well, yeah, they are. But
yeah, of course they are.
So is a hell of a lot of others, but it doesn't mean to say they're
It's well done, though. Yeah.
Well, so are the Nero Wolf stuff, but, you know, so what? They're all well done. And you look at the story as it stands in front of you, and if it stands up as these do, that's all you can ask for. And these are quite good. I really enjoy these. Yeah, I'm going to use quite good again. Chong will give me a hard time over that one. But really enjoyed these. They're exceptional. But quality-wise, not way up there, but they are a favourite. And again, as we've been saying all the way right through with this, David, these are not necessarily the best books of the year, because we can't say that because we haven't read everything. But these are the favourites. That we've enjoyed the most.
Yeah.
Of this particular year, and that's really what counts.
Sure, indeed. All right. So what are we rolling on to now?
You're doing the history and historical fiction and histories, David.
Yes. So I bundled this category as my top historical fiction / history, because I bundled in a book which isn't fiction at all, but is certainly reads like a novel anyway. So, and that's there's only four of these. It's not top five, just the top four. Number four was Queen Victoria by Lytton Strachey. Now, this was a production I did for Standard eBooks, but I think I had read in the past anyway. It's not fiction, it's history, but it reads kind of almost like a novel. It's very entertaining. Lytton Strachey had a wonderful style, and he writes very sort of ironically, and he likes to puncture people's pretensions. He put out a book called Eminent Victorians, which really punctured the, you know, what we call it, the hagiography around characters of the Victorian era, like Florence Nightingale and General Gordon and people like that. And but he writes very entertainingly, and this is his book about Queen Victoria. A lot of it, in fact, is about Prince Albert, who is in this reading anyway, is a really interesting character, and it's a great pity that he died so young, as he did. Anyway, that was that. Number three on my list was What the Wind Brings by Matthew Hughes, which I talked about at length on the podcast and interviewed Matthew Hughes about it too. Very nice historical fiction with a tinge of fantasy, a bit of fantasy element to it. It set in South America not long after the Spaniards arrived. Number two on my list, which I think is I should characterize as historical fiction, How Much of These Hills is Gold by C. Pam Jung. Terrific, set in California during the gold mining era or gold rush era. Very, very well done indeed. Again, this is another book I saw was on Barack Obama's list of best books read during the year. He has good taste, that man. And number one, as again, as you'd expect if you've been listening to the podcast, my favorite historical fiction of the year was The Mirror and the Light by Hilary Mantel. And this is the third and concluding volume of her trilogy about Thomas Cromwell, all of which are excellent. Really well done. And this was no exception. So that's my list of that. Right, so what you got, Perry?
I'm now going to move on to novellas. We've discussed these on and off, mainly on the when we were talking about the Hugo Awards and those that were appeared on the ballot. The novella is that story that exists between around about 10,000 and 40,000 words, somewhere around there. So short novels. Occasionally, you go back and look at the old science fiction magazine, they refer to them as full-length novels, but they're not. Or they refer to them as short novels. The term novella started to come in around about the mid-60s, but the Hugos weren't being given out for novellas until probably the late 60s, and that was more than likely because the Nebula Award, given out by the Science Fiction and Fantasy Writers of America, actually had, when they first started, they had four fiction categories. But we'll get to that when we talk about the Hugo Time Machine, because we'll refer to the Nebulas at the same time so we can compare what was happening in each of those two awards. Anyway, I like novellas. I think novellas are a really good length for the science fiction and fantasy and horror categories, because the author can't mess about. You can't have a whole lot of padding in this. It's just basically got to get in there, and it's just got to be short, sharp and sweet. You look at things like the Maigret novels, all around about 125, 150 pages. They're all novellas in this instance. There's no messing about. You don't get a lot of stuff that goes on other than Maigret trying to figure out what's going on with this particular problem. Same thing in the SF category here. You're getting a particular thing that the author wants to deal with, and they hit it and hit it hard. I read 18 of these during the year. These are all standalones, so they're not the ones that were included in short story collections. Rosa Ecclesiastes, of course, won't be in this, although whether that was a novella or novelette, hard to say. Again, because you don't get word counts terribly much, it's sometimes hard to work out how long a particular story is. But these were particularly published as being novellas. And next year in this particular year coming up, I've decided that I'm going to start registering all of the novellas I read, even if they aren't standalone. So I'll be able to add those in to this particular category as well. But these are sold as standalone novels or standalone books. First one, Sisters of the Vast Black by Linda Rather. First thing that I'd ever read by her. This is nuns and religion in a space opera. It's very strange. Very strange, and quite excellent. And when I first picked it up, I thought, "Oh, is this going to be any good?" So I read somebody said it was going to be all right, and no, I enjoyed this. But I was impressed by this one. Number four, Prosper's Demon by K.J. Parker. K.J. Parker is a pen name of the fantasy writer Tim Holt, and he writes a number of sort of more. He writes a number of fantasy novels which are more on the darker side under his pseudonym of K.J. Parker. Tim Holt, I believe, is, which I haven't read anything by him under that name, are more of the lighter stuff. But he writes really well. It's about a guy that is an artist that utilises a demon to be able to help him produce the works of art that he wants in record time. Number three, The Dragon Masters by Jack Vance. We don't need to talk about this. You've already mentioned it in a separate category, in your fantasy category, although I put this specifically into my novella list. Yep. One of the all-time greats of the SF or fantasy fields. Number two is a book by an Australian writer, Helen Garner. Now, this is called The Children's Bark. This is a non-genre. This could have fitted into my literary category. And while it's not actually listed as a particular novella, it's only just over 100 pages long. And so, looking at it from a different perspective, I decided to put it into the novella category as opposed to normal literary novels. She's got a very interesting technique. Given if this story had been given to a whole lot of other literary authors, it would have been 300 pages. All the gaps in it would have been filled in, but she leaves those gaps, so she'll move it so it can read like it's episodic. But if you stick with it and you read it all in one big hit, because that's what the one thing about novellas are for. You get yourself a couple of hours, you sit down, you pick up the book and you read it and you finish it. Now, I know I read, as I've been told, I read reasonably quickly because I read about probably 50, 60 pages an hour. But I'd be able to read these in under 2 hours. So you can find a 2 hour time, sit down, get stuck into it and read it, plane journeys, that sort of stuff. They start and they get right to it and you get everything you need in it. And if you read it in that instance, if you read this, The Children's Bark by Helen Garner, in that particular fashion, those gaps will be filled in. You will fill them in yourself. And you come to realize that she's taken out all of the extraneous stuff that she doesn't really need because she can get all the rest of the story out of what she's talking about. Set in inner city Melbourne in the late 80s, early 90s. Very interesting book. And I'll be looking at more of Garner's stuff in the future. Number one, This Is How You Lose the Time War by M.L.L. Motar and Max Gladstone. This was the big novella in the genre for 2019, winner of the Hugo Award, the Nebula Award, and the Locus Novella Award. It's a love story told against a time war across different time frames. It's innovative, although it is reminiscent of Time Was by Ian MacDonald, the novella I think we discussed a few years back. The more I think about This Is How You Lose the Time War and Time Was, I feel more and more sorry that Time Was did not get the recognition that it deserved because it was truly excellent. Honourable mentions for the year: The Haunting of Tramcar 15, which I discussed when we were talking about Hugo Awards, because I believe it was nominated for that. And We Are All Completely Fine by Daryl Gregory. I've got this as an honourable mention, but for the life of me, I can't really think terribly much about it. I must have read it some time ago. But anyway, this is the see, well, one of the other things I wanted to mention here was that, and it comes up a bit later on, when I went back to have a look at all of the entries in my books read for 2020, you know, as I've been telling you and the listener that I've been basically giving them a number out of into one decimal place out of five. Some of them I've gone back to and I've had a look and I thought, why did I give it that number? I don't know. Well, I've got to go with what I did. And then I look at something else and go, God, that should have been higher than that, surely. So some look as though they're too high, some look as though they're too small. I don't know. Don't know what to do about that. I think we'll just leave it and just move on. You know, wave our hands a little bit, David, and just sort of say, no. Nothing to see here. Everything's fine. Now, you are going to talk about the next one, non-fiction.
No,
No?
I'm going to slip in a stealth category.
Oh, dear. You're like my wife at Christmas lunch. Look, there's another course, dear. Okay, thanks for that. Anyway, yes, David, surprise me.
This is a category which I forgot to tell Perry about, so it didn't appear on our list. So it's a surprise for him. Anyway, this is children's literature, which is an important category for me. I like reading kids' books, what you might call kids' books, or books written for young people, because why should kids have all the fun? There's some terrific material out there. So I'll relatively quickly go through children's literature. So, number five on my list was Clockwork by Philip Pullman, who also wrote things like His Dark Materials, but short little book, but very clever. Harding's Luck by Edith Nesbit, or E. Nesbit as she wrote as. She was writing in the Edwardian era. So this came out in 1909, I think. And it's the sequel to a book called The House of Arden. I really like her books, and they're really interesting because they kind of go against the grain of a lot of the children's literature of the time. She, her young people in her books are getting into all sorts of scrapes, and they're just very ordinary kids. They get their knees dirty, and they get cuts and scratches, and they break the rules, and they do all sorts of things which they're not supposed to. But and then she introduces sort of fantasy elements, which work very well. And the other thing to say about Dies Nesbitt is that she was a very interesting character in herself. There's been some very interesting books written about her, but she was a member of the Fabian Society, which is sort of a progressive society in the late 1900s and early 20th century. She was a good friend of H.G. Wells, and in fact, a number of things in her books relate to H.G. Wells. So anyway, Howling's Like Well, I thought was really, really quite excellent. Number three on my list, which is a book I did as a product for Standard eBooks, which was Just William by Richmond Crompton. Most young people of my generation would remember the William books by Richmond Crompton. A lot of fun. Number two was Tom's Midnight Garden by Philippa Pearce, which I talked about a fair bit on the podcast, so I won't go into it again. And number one on my list, again, I've talked about it on the podcast, number one on my list was I Was a Rat by Philip Pullman. It's this lovely thing where these elderly couple are sitting there one night at dinner, and there's a knock on the door, and this very late at night, they're very puzzled by this knock on the door, and they open the door, and there's this young boy sort of in a uniform, but sort of been bashed around a bit, and he just says, "I was a rat," and it goes on from there. It's a clever, clever book. Loved it. And it's also quite good social commentary about the way the media works and the way our view of royalty works. Clever stuff. So, having stolen the category there, Perry, I might throw it back to you for the non-fiction category.
Thanks for that, David. So moving on to non-fiction. Again, this is another category where I didn't read enough during the year. I only read five, and I'm only going to mention three for this. Number three, Hero with a Thousand Faces. This was mentioned in our anniversary episode way back in April last year, where I listed it as probably my favourite non-fiction book, and yet it only fits as number three in this, because the rereading of it led me to think, maybe it wasn't as good as I thought it was originally. And that was the only one of the books from my favourites last time which didn't measure up as much as I had remembered. I still enjoyed it. I still think it's good. I just don't think it measured up as far. This is about the hero's journey. Excellent stuff, but I remembered it as being tighter, and this time when I read it, it just seemed to be a bit too loose and not. He wasn't running his argument definitively enough for me. Anyway, that's just it. Number two, Zona, a book about a film, about a journey to a room. This is by Jeff Dyer, and this is Jeff Dyer's account of watching the film Stalker, based on the Stanislavski novel Roadside Picnic. And I spoke about this when we talked about Stalker and Roadside Picnic and how it greatly influenced my understanding and feeling about the film. And the two of them bounced off each other. And I was because I was reading the book while I was watching the film. So I'd watch about 5 minutes of the film and then read the parts of the book and then go back and move it around. It was quite a surreal and but very, very interesting experience. Now, I believe that he has also written a similar book about his experience of watching another film. And the book is called Broadsword Calling Danny Boy. Does that ring a bell?
No, what's the film it's based on?
I think it's based on Where Eagles Dare.
Oh, okay.
So, where it's Richard Burton and Clint Eastwood.
Okay, yeah.
Odd pairing, but there we go. So that might be an interesting one to go and have a bit of a look at another point, because let me tell you, the previous experience of this was pretty damn good. But my number one non-fiction book for the year was Unreliable Memoirs by Clive James. So the first volume of his autobiographical series, it was an absolute revelation when it first appeared. I laughed out loud a couple of times in this, and I'd read it a couple of times before, and they do say on the blurb, "Don't read this on the bus because you'll laugh outside." And everybody goes, "Oh no, that's not right." Until you get to the point, suddenly you burst out laughing. It's just damn funny, and while it's irreverent, sometimes silly, there's a lot of heart in this, and he's not James is not averse to hinting that he wasn't as good as he could have been as a kid. He doesn't come right out and say that he was well, he wasn't a nasty piece of work, but he was just very self-centered, which a lot of kids are. But he didn't change much, and first opportunity he gets to leave the family nest and leave Sydney and go to England, he grabs it and he's off, and that's where the book ends. I'll be probably picking up one or two more volumes of this during the year because it's good to remember. It's good to remember James, who died was in the end of 2019, I think. And he was an excellent writer. No honourable mentions for me. That's it. Just those three.
Fair enough. Okay, so my non-fiction. Again, I didn't read a lot. In fact, I only read five, but I'll mention them all anyway. So number five on my list was a book called Live Wired, all one word, Live Wired. The subtitle is The Inside Story of the Ever-Changing Brain by David Eagleman. And it's a bit disappointing, actually, but it's fundamentally about the plasticity. I've said it again, plasticity of the human brain and how it can adapt to any form of input. Like it talks about things like bionic ears and how the signals from things like that are really extremely crude, but the brain is able to take them and make sense of them and map them to its experience, the person's experience. So it was interesting, but not greatly written, I didn't think. Number four on my list was Sea People, The Puzzle of Polynesia by Christina Thompson. Interesting stuff about the Polynesians and the way they travelled across the vast distances of the Pacific. Number three on my list is a book I probably should have talked about on the podcast, but never got around to it, which is a book called The Erratics, a memoir by Vicky Lavoe Harvey. Now, this actually won the Stella Prize for the year in which it came out, I think it was 2 or 3 years ago. And the Stella Prize is an Australian Literary Award for women-only authors. But it's non-fiction. It's about essentially about her family, the last period or the last days of her family. Her mother is in hospital and her father has been left behind. But her mother is obviously a very dominant character, and it's a very interesting book. It's well worth reading. Anyway, number two on my list is Dark Emu by Bruce Pascoe, which we've talked about on the podcast in the past. Very interesting. Certainly makes the case for a reassessment of the Aboriginal society in Australia when the first Europeans arrived. And my top in this category, and again, this is about books I enjoyed the most during the year, and I certainly enjoyed this book, and I'm going to be rereading it many times in the future. It's a collection of essays by Philip Pullman, and the book is called Demon Voices, or Daemon Voices, however you like to pronounce that. And it's a collection of essays about writing and about a whole lot of things, but mainly focused on writing. Really excellent. He's wonderful, very wise, very interesting, very well written. Excellent stuff. Really enjoyed that a lot. It's a very, very good book. So that's my non-fiction category.
Okay, thanks, David. That's good. We've been through a lot of categories today, and in fact, as I look at the recording clock, we've now been going for quite some time, way over our appointed hour that we normally would. So we're really going to have to finish this next week, David. And I normally come out and I say, "Yeah, we'll see you next week," meaning that next episode. But in this instance, we really are going to do that next week, due to the fact that I'm going to be travelling around Victoria for a bit of a holiday at the end of January in a fortnight. We've decided to bring our next episode forward a week, and we're going to be recording that in 7 days' time. That was originally going to be our best TV and film of the year, but we're going to finish off our best books of the year first up next time. So we'll do that then, and then we will move on to the best film and TV that we saw of the year. So I think that's pretty good. I think we've probably given people a lot of books to have a think about, David. If you're going to list these in the show notes, I'm going to have to send you my full list, otherwise you'll never be able to remember all of these. And having to work your way through and transcribe them all is going to be a right royal pain. And you wouldn't really want to do that. So I think we're done.
Yep. And we'll see you all next week.
Literally next week.
Indeed.
Thanks, David. See you then.